It's time for the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Welcome to the 8th episode of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. This week we've got some exciting news from the South African Astronomical Observatory about an interesting exoplanet discovery. But first, here's Catherine to tell us all about Venus.
As one of the classic planets, Venus has been a familiar sight to humanity ever since we first started looking at the stars. Like Mercury, Venus's movements are bound to the Sun, but the similarities end there. Venus moves more slowly and wanders further. It also shines extremely brightly. Only the Sun and the Moon are brighter than Venus. Venus is easily identified as the evening or morning star and often passes near to the Moon, putting on a breathtakingly beautiful display to anybody who happens to notice. With its dazzling beauty and gracefully sweeping paths across the sky, it makes sense that the Romans associated it with the goddess Venus. Venus was a very colorful character, and her myths and legends were particularly spicy. When the youngest of the Titans, Cronus, led a rebellion against his father, Uranus, he took out his frustrations by castrating Uranus with a sickle. When the blood from the wound splashed into the ocean, a great froth rose up, which floated to shore. When the foam dissipated, it revealed a breathtakingly beautiful new goddess. The Greeks called her Aphrodite, and the Romans adopted her as their own under the name Venus. Incidentally, some versions of the story have her rising out of a seashell instead, hence the famous birth of Venus motif. Venus had spectacular beauty and sex appeal, and she loved to use them. When she was ushered up to Mount Olympus, chaos ensued as all the male gods began competing for her attentions and fighting for the privilege of marrying her. Jupiter dealt with the situation by decreeing that she would marry Vulcan, Hephaestus to the Greeks. Vulcan was the artificer of the gods and blacksmith. He was both lame and ugly, and the exact opposite of what Venus wanted. Vulcan crafted a magical girdle for Venus of gold and fine jewels. This would make the wearer completely irresistible to the opposite sex. It was a spectacularly stupid move, for Venus's charms and insatiable appetites were matched only by her unfaithfulness. She had affairs with whomever she pleased, and while she preferred sleeping with gods, she wasn't above seducing particularly attractive mortals. Her list of lovers is impressive, especially considering that she bore most of them children. But first in her heart was mighty Mars. Whenever Vulcan was away, they would indulge their passions in Vulcan's bed. Venus gave Mars two sons, Phoebus and Deimos, and a daughter, Harmonia. Sadly for the couple, the sun god Helios saw everything and told Vulcan what was going on. The enraged smith forged a magical golden net, which he used to ensnare the lovers. He pinned them to the bed to be exposed for all the other gods' amusement. However, despite the romance and passion of the mythology behind Venus, the planet has a totally different nature. Venus was once called the twin of Earth because they have almost the same size, mass, and internal structure. Yet more recent observations have revealed Venus to be a very different place. Venus is closer to the Sun than Earth, orbiting at about 100 million kilometers, and it rotates backwards. On Venus, the sun rises in the west and sets in the east. But somebody standing on Venus would never see this, because the atmosphere is more than 90 times denser than Earth's and composed mostly of carbon dioxide. Modern understanding of carbon dioxide's properties as a greenhouse gas come from observations of Venus. The greenhouse effect has raised the temperature on the surface of Venus to over 460 degrees Celsius. That's hot enough to melt lead. Also, it has permanent 100% cloud cover and rains sulfuric acid. So Venus is probably the closest place to hell in the solar system. Only two landers have ever been sent to Venus, and both failed within minutes after landing, suffering from a combination of crushing pressure and baking temperatures. It is safe to say that Venus will probably never be colonized. So while Venus the goddess may have been a hot-blooded woman, she had nothing on the planet.
In the constellation of the Sextant lies a star, invisible to the naked eye. Until recently, it was known only by its catalogue number, HD 93396. But recently, a robotic telescope in Sutherland, South Africa, called KELT South, detected a slight dimming in its brightness, lasting 7 hours and repeating every 4.7 days. It had found an exoplanet. The star was renamed KELT 11 and the planet KELT 11b. KELT South is one of a pair of robotic telescopes. The name is an acronym for Kilodegree Extremely Little Telescope, and its job is to repeatedly scan a large portion of the sky, watching some 5 million stars for any changes in brightness that might indicate that they have exoplanets transiting across their disks. KELT South's partner is called KELT North, and it's in Arizona in the USA. KELT 11 is currently the brightest star known to have transiting exoplanets in the Southern Hemisphere. At 8th magnitude, it is too dim to see with the naked eye, but it's easily visible through regular binoculars. KELT 11b, like most known exoplanets, is what we call a hot Jupiter, meaning that it's a gas giant like Jupiter, but it orbits so close to its star that it has a temperature measured in thousands of degrees Celsius. It is extremely inflated, meaning that its atmosphere is swollen, puffed out to a far larger extent than we might normally expect for a planet like this. Although KELT 11b is more than twice the size of Jupiter, it only has about a quarter of the mass, making it just a little bit lighter than Saturn. That makes it one of the most inflated and least dense planets ever discovered. It's comparable to styrofoam. The star itself is a subgiant at a stage in its life described by astronomers as being in the Hertzsprung gap. That means that it is busy transiting between life stages. Stars spend most of their lives as what we call main sequence stars. That's when they are powered by the fusion of hydrogen into helium in their cores. However, this hydrogen does eventually run out, and when that happens, the internal structure of the star changes until a new equilibrium is found. In the case of massive stars like KELT 11, this involves a region of hydrogen fusion forming in a shell around the hotter core, which now fuses helium into other heavier elements. KELT 11 is currently in this transition zone, where this shell has probably not yet formed, and since it is such a brief stage in a star's evolution, the researchers have a very precise figure for its age. When the transition is complete, the star will then begin to swell, and over the next 60 or so million years, completely engulf KELT 11b. KELT 11b is a very useful exoplanet because of how puffed out its atmosphere is. When starlight passes through a planet's atmosphere, spectroscopes can be used to watch how the light changes and see exactly what the atmosphere is made from, and see what the atmosphere's chemical composition is. With KELT 11b's atmosphere being so thinned out and distended, astronomers will be able to see particularly deep inside the planet to see what it's made from, and so learn a great deal more about how gas giant planets are built. And since this stage of the star's life is so short, in galactic terms at least, we are extremely lucky to have found it with a planet that is so interesting to study. Back in 2014, my wife was pregnant and spending a lot of time on the internet in pregnancy forums. This was about the same time as a large number of lunar eclipses that were visible in North America. And she was surprised to see a surprising number of women were very concerned about watching the lunar eclipse while pregnant. She called me to have a look at this, and I was interested to find a superstition that I'd never heard of before. So I wrote an article about it on the Urban Astronomer website, and it is to date the single most popular thing I've ever written. So I thought I'd reprise it here. Now, it just seems a really odd thing because we'd never heard of this before, but it turns out that this is in fact quite a widespread superstition. So what's going on? Well, first off, let's recap blood moons. A short while ago, some pastors published their blood moon prophecy in which they described a coming tetrad of blood red moons. The timing of these blood moons had religious significance and was supposed to be a sign of coming troubles. Now, it's interesting to me for how they've used scary language to describe a perfectly ordinary phenomenon that happens every single year, and I've written about it before, but the short version is this. A blood moon is nothing more or less than a lunar eclipse. There are between 3 and 5 of these every single year, although they're usually not all visible from the same place. At the deepest point of the eclipse, light refracting through the Earth's atmosphere into the shadow lights the moon up dimly in various shades of orange and red. Although as somebody who has actually seen both blood and lunar eclipse, I can categorically state that the moon never becomes blood red. Still, blood moon captures the imagination, has a certain ring to it, and the name seems to have stuck. So when I first heard about the warnings to pregnant women to avoid blood moons, I assumed it must just be part of the minor hysteria at the time over yet another doomsday prophecy. But then, after I did a bit of homework, well, it turned out that this belief goes back to ancient times. It seems that the Aztecs believed that if a pregnant woman was exposed to the sight of a lunar eclipse, various terrible things would happen to her unborn baby. The list of deformities includes birthmarks, hair lips, club feet, bad teeth, and even just being ugly. These beliefs persist today in Mexico and seem to be common among Hispanic American people, and the standard advice given in these communities seems to be that pregnant women should wear red, they should stick safety pins in their clothing, or possibly their underwear, depending who you ask, they should avoid sharp objects or touch metal, they should avoid magnets, they should lie face down without moving on their beds for the duration of the eclipse. And as somebody who's ever been pregnant could probably tell you that sounds awfully uncomfortable, and probably countless other variations on those basic themes. Interestingly, there are similar beliefs to be found in India, with even medical professionals, doctors and nurses, advising women to avoid the eclipse. It turns out that countries around the world have their own superstitions about the moon and lunar eclipses. With the exception of Muslim states, who treat the lunar eclipse as a time for worship, forgiveness, and prayer, these events have traditionally been seen as bad omens, portending wars and famines and the deaths of kings and so on. It's always like that with astrology, though, isn't it? Any change in the heavenly order, like an eclipse or a comet or a nova, well, they're all bad omens that are bad, and nothing is ever good. Fortunately, as astronomers, we know a little bit better that there is nothing special about the alignment of the moon, sun, and earth that has any effect at all on people living on earth. To see why the effects predicted by these superstitions make no sense, well, let's examine the situation a bit more closely. An eclipse, lunar or solar, happens when the earth, the moon, and the sun are all lined up accurately enough for one of those bodies to fall into the shadow of another. The geometry of the situation means that when this alignment happens, the moon is either full, giving us a lunar eclipse, or it is new, giving a solar eclipse. Because the Earth's shadow is so much bigger than the moon's, it is far easier for the moon to drift into the Earth's shadow than for the Earth to intercept the moon's shadow. And so lunar eclipses happen every few months, while solar eclipses are quite a bit rarer. Now, some people will point out the alignment as being unusual, bringing various forces to bear on the surface of the Earth, but if that were the case, we would notice strange things happening every full and new moon. I've heard it claimed that the moon works with magnetism, and that all those magnets line up during the eclipse, but, well, that's obviously false. The moon's magnetic field is extremely weak, so much so that it can't protect itself at all from the sun's radiation. Meanwhile, the Earth's quite powerful magnetic field is on all the time, and doesn't seem to hurt us one bit. Other people will talk about the amplified gravitational effects, but that makes even less sense, because we feel those gravitational effects twice a day, every day, in the form of tides. Like the magnetic fields, the tides don't seem to have any effect at all on our health or our fortunes. It does make sense that the strong forces that we're all so familiar with don't do anything to us at all, while the fainter and rarer ones do. So if anybody tells you to be frightened of the moon, don't be. It's a lump of dead rock. It's almost 400,000 kilometers away. It can't hurt you or your baby, not even if you forget to pin red ribbons to your underwear. And that's the end of another episode. A short one, but heartfelt. And sadly delayed by everything from plumbing emergencies at home to stress at the day job to urgent calls to go see our kids' teachers at school. So if you've been hanging around wondering when this episode would finally drop, well, now you know. And I appreciate your patience. A lesser fan would have probably unscribed by now and gone to check if the new season of Serial is out yet, but you're better than that. And if you're not a subscriber, well, why not become one? The classic podcast tool is, of course, iTunes, although I got an email from Apple recently to tell me that iTunes podcasts are now called Apple Podcasts, so, you know, make of that what you will. But there are plenty of other options. Just search podcast in your app store, whether you're on Apple, Android, or Windows. And once all that's set up, just click the subscribe link on www.urban-astronomer.com and follow the instructions to have each episode delivered to your device as soon as it is released. It's all just so gosh darn convenient. Everyone is looking at you and wondering why you haven't done it yet. Seriously though, all the cool kids are doing it, and you really should subscribe, and you should do it now. First one's free, and so are all the other ones. Anyway, so, subscribe to the podcast feed, leave a comment on the show notes for the episode, tweet me at youastronomer, leave a message on the Facebook page, and oh yeah, I'll be launching a Patreon page soon. If you really like the show, enough to want to be a part of it, then you'll be able to use the Patreon page to sponsor a small amount of cash to cover my expenses and maybe even let me draw a little bit for my own time, which would be nice. I do say I love getting paid for things. Although, of course, if you can't spare anything or even if you just don't want to, well, that's fine. I won't judge you or hold it against you, and I'm not going to take the website or podcast away from you or anything. But there will be extra features made available for patrons. And one of the first things that I'm going to ask all you potential patrons is to tell me exactly what sort of things you'd like. So the Patreon page will go live in the next few weeks, and I'll announce it here on the show, and that's when you can send your feedback to let me know what it is that you'd like me to do for you. Until next week then, clear skies.